From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Mark Wahlberg talks about starring in the Oscar-winning film The Fighter, based on the story of boxer Mickey Ward. It's now out on DVD. And we'll talk with the film's director, David O. Russell, who also worked with Wahlberg on I Heart Huckabees and Three Kings. Also, we remember two luminaries of stage and screen who died this week. Our critic-at-large, John Powers, looks back on the career of Elizabeth Taylor. And we'll listen back to a 1992 interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Lanford Wilson. Later, I'll have a review of Mildred Pierce, the HBO miniseries that premieres this weekend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. The movie The Fighter, starring Mark Wahlberg as boxer Mickey Ward, continues to generate momentum long after it hit theaters. Last month, the movie won Academy Awards for supporting actor Christian Bale, who plays Mickey's boxing half-brother Dickie Eklund, and for supporting actress Melissa Leo, who plays Alice, their firebrand mother and manager. The Fighter is now out on DVD, and this week, reports are swirling that the filmmakers are close to committing to a sequel. Our guests today are Mark Wahlberg, the star of The Fighter and one of its producers, and the movie's director, David O. Russell, who also directed Wahlberg in the films Three Kings and I Heart Huckabees. Terry Gross spoke with them in January. But before we get to their conversation, let's hear a clip from The Fighter. Older brother Dickie's boxing career has been cut short by his crack habit, but he and his mother continue to work with little brother Mickey. Mickey's new girlfriend Charlene, played by Amy Adams, thinks they're holding him back, and she and his boxing coach, Mickey O'Keefe, who plays himself, convince Mickey to stop working with his mother and brother. When they hear that news, they show up at the gym to confront the coach, the girlfriend, and Mickey himself. In this clip, the trainer speaks first.
We're going to train. They got to go.
They got to go, Mick. Come on.
Hey, all right?
Ask him, George. Ask him if he would have won Sanchez without his brother.
Take him outside, right?
No, I wouldn't have won Sanchez if it wasn't for Dickie.
How can you say that to O'Keefe?
Because it's true. Right, I went in without a game plan. It wasn't working, so I went back to what I learned with Dickie. And I wouldn't have won without you either, O'Keefe, okay? I mean, you know that. We worked hard. You got me ready.
You got your confidence and your focus from O'Keefe, and from Sal, and your father, and from me. Dickie's a junk bag.
Hey.
He's a junk bag.
Why am I the problem? I'm his blood. I'm his family.
I'm the one fighting, okay? Not you, not you, and not you. I know what I need.
And you need Dickie?
I want Dickie back. And I want you, Charlene. And I want O'Keefe. I want my family. What's wrong with that?
Mark Wahlberg had wanted to make a movie about Mickey Ward for years. They first met when Wahlberg was 18. Wahlberg grew up close to Lowell, Massachusetts, where Mickey and Dickie were from. Terry asked Mark Wahlberg how he prepared for this very physical role.
Now, you trained for 4 years to play a boxer, and during those 4 years you made other movies. So how is a boxer's body different from the kind of body you've needed for other roles? Because, you know, you've been muscular for other roles, but maybe the muscles of a boxer are different?
You know, it's not so much the way you look as far as your physique. It's the way you move, the way you punch, footwork, all of those things. You know, if you look at a lot of boxers don't look like bodybuilders, don't necessarily have a beach type of physique. But, you know, it's just, I didn't want to look like an actor who could skip a little rope, and if you shoot him the right way and edit it the right way, that he could look pretty decent in the ring. I wanted to look like a real boxer who could actually go and win the title. And that meant the only way to do it is to put the work in. And, you know, being left-handed, Mickey was right-handed, and wanting to really look like Mickey did in those fights. And the only thing that would separate this film from other boxing movies was in the realism within the fights themselves.
So, David O. Russell, Mark Wahlberg trained for 4 years to do this movie, and then you had to direct him in the ring. And he had to take a lot of punches in this film because the boxing strategy of his character is to take a lot of punches and just kind of stand there until he could deliver a real body punch to his opponent in the hopes of knocking him out, which he sometimes succeeds in doing. So when you were directing Wahlberg and his boxing opponents in the ring, were you concerned about real injuries that might happen or real pain that they'd be inflicting on each other unintentionally? Even if you plan on giving 60% in a punch, it might end up being more.
Absolutely. You don't want your star to get hurt in the ring. And yet at the same time, it was a blessing that Mark is someone who had been in a lot of fights on the streets and had been to prison. And so he wasn't going to pamper himself either. So we knew that we could get great, something that felt very raw and very real, and push it to the edge. You save some of the hardest hits till your last takes. though, just to be careful, just to, because then you don't, if you get it in the last take, but it hasn't ruined the day.
Now, you actually asked an HBO film crew from the early 90s, from the period that the movie is set in, to shoot the boxing scenes so that it would look just like HBO was televising it. What are some of the things that they did and some of the places they put their cameras that you might not have thought of yourself?
Well, they have sort of this way that covers the whole ring. It was from one direction. They mostly covers it from one direction where they have six cameras. You know, they have two that are parked in the middle stands looking at the ring from one side, different distances. And they have two on the other side. So that's three sides of the ring. And then they have two floaters who... I never noticed this until I saw it. These guys dress all in black and they stand on what's called the apron of the ring, which is just outside the ropes, and they walk everywhere handheld. And those kind of became my favorite guys because the handheld style, or the Steadicam style, is what I like the best.
David, when you were asked by Mark Wahlberg to direct The Fighter, what did you relate to about the story? Unlike Mark Wahlberg, you didn't grow up near Mickey Ward. He was probably not one of your heroes. I'm not sure you were even interested in boxing. So what spoke to you about the story?
Well, I immediately recognized that the characters in their world were very... They had a quality of realness that was kind of fascinating to me, and that they were just characters that I was fascinated by, which some of my favorite movies have. So right off the bat, you know, I recognize some of the flavors from my own family, you know, whether it's my family in the Bronx or Brooklyn, my own mother, you know, and the fact that there was the women made the story very special to me in combination with these brothers and their brothers' dynamic. The bartender, you know, the women helped make the men what they were, or were so pivotal to the story. And I had not seen that before. And I had been an organizer up in those parts, so I did know these people to some degree. Of course, not to the degree that Mark did, but I also knew it was a piece of Mark's heart, and I knew that there was going to be something very good and real there.
Let's play a scene from the film, and we'll hear how everybody talks. And this is a scene where Mickey, the Mark Wahlberg character, has decided, at the urging of his girlfriend and his boxing trainer, to fire his family, basically to tell his mother she's not managing him anymore. And so the mother is really angry, and she gathers all of her seven daughters in the car and drives over to Mickey's girlfriend's house, where Mickey and his girlfriend, played by Amy Adams, are. And so they all get out of the car. The mother's furious. The sisters are furious, and they're all ready to give Mickey hell. So the first person to speak is Charlene, Mickey's girlfriend, played by Amy Adams.
Hi.
Well, 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 look at this.
Look at what?
Are you hiding from us, Mickey?
He's not hiding.
I wasn't talking to you. I was talking to my son. What are you doing, Mixer, huh?
I'm right here. I ain't hiding from nobody else.
What are you gonna do? Turn your back on Dickie next, huh? All we ever wanted for you was to be world champion.
Mickey's a grown man. He can think for himself.
Shut your mouth.
Skank. Don't call me skank. I'll rip that nasty hair right out of your head.
I'm his mother. And his manager.
You're not my manager anymore. And I'm not waiting for Dickie, okay? I'm not getting any younger.
Who's gonna look after you, sweetheart? Come on. I know you don't understand it, but I had 9 kids. And I love every one of you the same.
You got a funny way of showing it, letting him get beat up, letting him get his hand broken.
You're crazy.
Boss! Mickey is my boss. What did I just say to you? What did I just say?
Such a great scene.
I think you could watch the whole, you know, just hear the audio of the whole movie.
It's great. And so, David O. Russell, I have to ask you, you said you were interested in the realness of the characters, but one thing I like about the movie is that the characters are all slightly more real than real. They're like slightly notched up, which makes you feel like you're really watching a movie. And I was wondering if you told everybody when you were directing them, like, give me just like a little bit more than real life.
Well, if you meet the real people, you'll realize that it's actually toned down. It really is, because that's why, you know, it's great for me seeing, you know, allowing the audience to see the real Dickie and Mickey together, and especially, well, not only the dynamic between the two of them, but also how big a personality Dickie is, as was Alice and Charlene and George and the rest of the sisters. I mean, it really is it's a toned-down version of them. I know that's hard to believe, because these people seem larger than life, but...
They're not a far throw from a lot of my relatives. And I love them, and I still am friends with them and go up there and see them.
There are seven daughters in the movie.
Seven beautiful sisters.
Yeah.
And I do think they're beautiful. People always say, well, those sisters, those ugly. I don't think they're ugly.
Well, as portrayed in the movie, from my point of view...
You thought they were ugly?
Well, here's the thing. They're so consumed by anger and resentment most of the time that mm-hmm. it turns them, and bitterness, mm-hmm. that it turns them kind of ugly or in some cases even grotesque, because they're just always seem to be on the verge of growling.
That's the pity I think of cinema sometimes, that you only have 2 hours to do the story, because I have a lot of love for those characters, and that's one of the things that made me want to make the movie. And I get what you're saying, which I think is true, because for the economy of telling the story, they come in like a hammer a bunch of times, and they're this intense pack, you know, or like some people compared them to the witches in Macbeth.
Or they're like their mother's entourage.
Yeah, well, they are. They're like her gang. And they're forceful. My mother's family, Italian-American family, same deal. She had four aunts who were like a gang, you know, with her mother, and very powerful women. But we shot other stuff, even though we didn't have a lot of time to do it. We shot interviews with them that I think we'll put on the DVD, which I had hoped, and the editor, Pam Martin, and I had a hard time letting go of these, because we were using that movie within a movie structure of the HBO movie that became the notorious thing of Lowell. And we were just, it gave us license to interview all the characters, including the gold that become the bookends of the film with Mickey and Dickie, which was not scripted. But we would interview the sisters, and they were talking about how much they loved Mickey and how they wanted to help him, and how unfair a fight was. And, you know, you just see a more mellow vein. But I get what you're saying.
One of the sisters in the movie is played by Conan O'Brien's sister, and I'm wondering how you cast her.
She just showed up at a casting call in Boston, and I didn't know she was his sister. Although when you step back, she looks like him in drag. You know, I mean, if you really think about it. Kate O'Brien, and she's a teacher, and she's, you know, and she, I don't think she acts a lot. She was we had a lot of real people we cast in the film, like Jill Queig.
Wait, is she the one who was in Gone Baby Gone?
Yes. Who has that? Every time she speaks, she gets a laugh.
It's that girl, Charlene.
Ma, it's a girl from the bar, Charlene. We got to get rid of her.
And the way we didn't have 10 different accents, as some movies have, is that I said, just follow Mark. Don't do no more, no less than Mark. And interestingly, it had been pointed out by another director that an accent can be a veil, not a performance. So you got to keep reminding the actors that their accent.
The great Mike Lee.
No, it was Mike Nichols.
Mike Nichols, sorry. Wrong guy.
But she's from the neighborhood, so she probably was just talking like herself.
Oh, right? Yeah, she's the real deal. We probably duked it out a couple of times when we were growing up.
Actor Mark Wahlberg and director David O. Russell of the movie The Fighter, which is now out on DVD. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview from January with actor Mark Wahlberg and director David O. Russell of The Fighter. It's been released on DVD, and there may be a sequel in the works.
Mark, after you made The Departed, you told me in an interview that your mother was really tough. I think you're described as one of the toughest women you'll ever see. Did you find characteristics from your mother in Mickey Ward's mother, and or at least in the Melissa Leo portrayal of her?
Well, there's so many similarities between my life and Mickey's life, Alice and my mom, you know, not just the fact that they both had 9 children. Mickey and I both had the older brother who was very much the apple of mom's eye and could do no wrong. But this is a true story. I was talking to my mother on the way over here on the phone, and she was like, you know, next time when you do an interview about me, can you just say how I was the best? Not that I was a machine or that I was tough or that I kicked your ass or that I threw your friends out of the house. Because I was on Ellen DeGeneres, and she had watched the show. And I always like telling the stories of my mom when she, like, you know, slaps me down or, you know, brings me back down to reality. But she literally on the way over here, and I didn't tell her that I was doing an interview, but I am now going to say she's the best.
Yeah, God bless.
So now I can talk about how tough she was again.
Yeah, exactly. Tell me a tough story.
I remember her coming to L.A. With Father Flavin, who is my parish priest, who's baptized all of my children, buried all my relatives that have passed, married my wife and I, and... you know, he's been such a huge part of my life for a long time. We went to an event together. I think it was a premiere, actually. And my mom was like, you know, don't worry about me, I'm fine. So I sent her in a car home with Father Flavin, and I think they got a little bit lost trying to get up to my house. They were driving, they had a driver. And then when I got home, she just gave me that, who the f*** do you think you are? You're not a f*** movie star. You're nothing. And I was like, whoa, you said you were going to be okay. I mean... I sent you in the car with a limousine home. But we laugh about that.
Oh, so can I tell the story about George and your dad?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Tell the story.
Yeah, there was when we met George, Mickey and Dickie's father, the roofer, who's a good man, one of the first things he said was to Mark was, he said, I knew your father in jail, and he's a really good man. And I love the fact that Mark's father and Mickey and Dickie's father were in prison together, and both good guys.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Small world.
Yeah. Well,
or what is
or
that?
Large
what
is
it?
Prison
said,
or something.
Said to people?
So Mark Wahlberg, David O. Russell, you've worked together on 3 films, Three Kings, I Heart Huckabees, and now The Fighter.
Well, I like everything about working with David, but my favorite thing, going back to Three Kings, you know, he's the writer-director, so obviously he's looking for something very specific, and my whole job and all I want to accomplish is making the director happy at the end of the day. So some tough emotional scenes were coming up, and I just went to him and said, dude, I really would rather you just kind of try to explain to me or show me what it is you're looking for, and he immediately would act out the scene. So it just became like a daily occurrence where I'd come to him and I'd be like, dude, you got to show me. And certainly for my own entertainment, watch him acting these scenes out. And it was just wonderful to watch. And really, he allowed me to become more confident as an actor and to let go of my fear and my insecurities. And that was what made me commit my undying commitment and passion and love and dedication to David.
Was that on the first film you did together that he did?
Yeah, that was on Three Kings.
So give me an example of what he did that you wouldn't have realized yourself.
Well, you know, like crying, for instance. There was a scene where I was supposed to be crying over my friend's body, and, you know, there's many ways to cry. Do you want the slow build? Do you want the big bawling? What do you want to do? And, you know, he just jumped right in there and did it. And I loved him for that. Because, you know, there's a crew of people, you know, everybody standing around and just kind of looking and watching. And, you know, it could be awkward. And for him to kind of make me feel comfortable in that way and just show that he was willing to do anything to help me, that meant a lot to me.
I think the key to it, I think, is if I'm willing to let go of my sense of embarrassment, I want to create an environment where everybody feels loose on the set. And I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah, and I come from a background of, you know, you're worried about how you're being perceived. You know, being a musician, being a rapper, being from the street, got to be cool, got to be tough, that whole thing. That was an issue for me for quite a while, you know. And that was obviously something that's a problem when you're an actor, because, you know, you want to be able to be as versatile as possible and play a lot of different roles.
Including
and
vulnerable.
So, Exactly. And I had that with Boogie Nights, but this was different. And David was he was just helped me overcome that.
David, did you pick up on that Mark was having trouble, or was it like self-conscious about playing vulnerable because he was so used to needing to be like strong and hip and all that stuff?
Yeah, I remember one of the first scenes was when he danced at the beginning of the movie with Spike Jones.
Oh, I hated that.
And he had danced for a living on stages all over the world. And he said, "You do it." And you're in front of like 100 extras and 100 casts. And so I like it. I appreciate it as a director because you get what it feels like. Oh, okay, now I got to dance. What am I going to do? But then I created the way I wanted it to look. And then it cracked him up. And whenever you can crack people up while you're doing some work, That's a good energy.
Actor Mark Wahlberg and director David O. Russell speaking to Terry Gross in January. The Fighter is now out on DVD, and if the rumors are accurate, there may eventually be a Fighter Part 2. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world and the connections between them, on newsstands, iPhone, and iPad, and at The Economist Online. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
Coming up, we remember two legends of the stage and screen. Our critic at large, John Powers, looks back at the life and career of Elizabeth Taylor, who died this week at age 79. And we'll listen back to a 1992 interview with the late playwright Lanford Wilson. Later, I'll have a review of Mildred Pierce. The 1941 novel and 1945 film is now a brand new HBO miniseries. This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bianculli. At the start of the fall TV season, HBO gave us the best new series of the year with Boardwalk Empire, which was set in the Prohibition era in Atlantic City, New Jersey. This weekend, HBO launches an ambitious, impressive 5-hour miniseries. And as with Boardwalk Empire, it's set during the Depression. But this one, called Mildred Pierce, is more intimate and, in the end, more emotional and more haunting. It's based on the 1941 novel by James M. Cain, about a middle-class woman trying to survive and feed and nurture her young daughters during very tough times. In 1945, it was one of three Kane stories made into a hit Hollywood movie in as many years, after Double Indemnity, but before The Postman Always Rings Twice. And the title role of Mildred Pierce won Joan Crawford an Oscar. This new HBO version hands the title role to Kate Winslet, who does wonders with it. It's directed by Todd Haynes, who wrote the screenplay adaptation with John Raymond, and they put almost all the drama's weight on the shoulders of their leading lady. Todd Haynes also directed I'm Not There, that brilliant fable of a movie in which different actors and actresses played Bob Dylan at various times in his life. But for Mildred Pierce, it's all about keeping it real. Astoundingly real, down to the period magazines and wallpaper, the food on the diner plates, and the slightly muted photography. Remaking the story of Mildred Pierce at this point in this decade is particularly shrewd. As the drama opens, in Glendale, California in 1931, Mildred's marriage to her husband Bert breaks up suddenly. It leaves her, in the early years of the Depression, with two young daughters, no prospects for work, and no idea how to keep going. It's easy to relate that sort of anxiety to today's financial meltdown. And even easier because Kate Winslet, early on, vanishes completely into the role of Mildred. She's determined to provide for her daughters, but a visit to an employment agency generates nothing except a lecture about how she isn't qualified to do anything but cook or clean. And during hard times, there are plenty of people willing to do that. But when Mildred is asked out for a date by a predatory friend of her soon-to-be ex-husband's, her neighbor has some more practical advice. And the neighbor is played by Melissa Leo, who follows up her Oscar-winning role in The Fighter with another winning performance.
Since when was Wally Bergen interested in you?
I don't think he ever was. But the second he heard Bert was gone, it was almost funny the effect it had on him.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that. The morals they give you credit for, you'd be surprised. To him, you were a red-hot mama the second he found out.
Found out what?
Grass Widow. Well, from now on, honey, you're fast.
Are you serious?
I am, and they are.
At first, this seems like a very old-fashioned, unenlightened narrative, suggesting that the only way for a woman to survive is to throw herself at a man. And even when the employment agent calls back with an out-of-the-blue job offer, Mildred doesn't see it as suitable.
I was over in Beverly the other night. And I got talking to this lady that's going to marry this director. And he doesn't know it yet, but his house is in for a big shakeup. So, she needs a housekeeper. And on account of all that fine domestic efficiency you were telling me about, I told her about you.
Well, I hardly know what to say. You see, I recently came across a similar job as a waitress, and I...
And you turned it down?
Well, I couldn't. I just can't go home and face my children knowing their mother works all day at taking tips and wearing a uniform and mopping up crumbs.
But you can face them just fine when there's nothing left to eat.
That will never be the case, Mrs. Turner.
It's no accident that in these early scenes, Mildred doesn't talk much. It takes a while for her to find her voice, and even longer to find a direction. Especially since the thought of taking that waitress job makes her sick. Literally sick. But she takes it anyway, and uses her skill at baking pies to bring in some extra money from the diner and to start her on her way. But this is James M. Cain, not some fairy tale. So not every turn in the story is a triumph, and not every man she meets is a prince. As actors, however, the men in Mildred's life, led by Guy Pearce as a dashing young playboy, are charming. And it's not until the fourth hour that Mildred's eldest daughter grows up enough to be played by Evan Rachel Wood, the vampire queen from True Blood. But she's worth the wait. Her defiant disdain of her mother's work ethic is one of the key elements in this miniseries, and ultimately provides its biggest payoff. And it's a different payoff than the one in the 1945 movie, because this version is more faithful to the original novel. I really, really enjoyed this miniseries, especially because it's perfect as a miniseries. The sheer length of the drama and the journey Mildred has to take makes her struggles more potent, more painful, and more real. Mildred Pierce is a masterpiece of modern film noir, or if you prefer, TV noir. And it's anchored by a performance by Kate Winslet that is unlikely to be beaten at next year's Emmys. Oh, and one last thing. HBO's Mildred Pierce will make you hungrier for pie than any television offering since Twin Peaks and Pushing Daisies. Select your TV snacks accordingly. Coming up, we listen back to part of a 1992 conversation between Terry Gross and Lanford Wilson, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright who died this week. This is Fresh Air. Lanford Wilson, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his 1980 play Tally's Folly, died this week of complications from pneumonia. He was 73 years old. Wilson is one of the playwrights who created the off-off-Broadway scene in the 1960s. His work was so popular, it ended up on Broadway. John Malkovich starred in the Broadway production of Wilson's Burn This. And Wilson's other acclaimed plays include Balm in Gilead, Hotel Baltimore, 5th of July, and Lemon Sky. He also co-founded New York's Circle Repertory Company, which produced plays by Jules Feiffer, Larry Kramer, Sam Shepard, and others. Terry Gross spoke with Lanford Wilson in 1992.
In the late 1960s, you co-founded Circle Repertory Theater in New York. What was the philosophy of the group?
Frankly, we wanted to become the Great American Theater, the Great American Theater Company. But we had done a number of plays. The group, even before we were founded, Marshall and I and Rob Thorkiel and Tanya, we'd done a number of plays that had large casts and ensemble acting that just took forever to rehearse and forever to get right. And in order to create an ensemble, you have to totally trust everyone else on stage with you, because otherwise you're going to make a very large choice and the actor is going to leave you hanging out there. I've seen actors on stage actually look at the audience like, what in the hell was that all about, when someone makes this huge, enormous choice. Well, so the actor, you have to trust that person to be there for you. And if that person is there for you, you can make deeper choices, and that person can make deeper choices. And it just, you can just create a much fuller, farther out, more profound experience. And that can only happen in ensemble, or if you happen to know the actor very well, or if you happen to be directed right. And so we wanted to create an ensemble, that kind of an ensemble that would take chances and would not leave the other person hanging out there.
One of your early successes was Hotel Baltimore. And this was about people in a hotel that's condemned.
Yes.
And in your early days in New York, you lived in welfare hotels, right?
Right. I first lived at a place that I never did learn the name of it. I think the hotel did not have a name.
Was it called Hotel?
it should have been. It was right across the street from Manhattan Hotel. And they answered the phone with something incomprehensible. I never did hear what it was. It sounded sort of like Hevro. And so we called it the Hevro Hilton. But it was definitely a welfare hotel. And then I moved from there down to the Broadway Central. And the week I moved out of the Broadway Central, the hotel collapsed.
Wow.
It fell completely into the ground. Fortunately, it did it slowly. It did it over a period of about a day and a half, so everyone got out. But so I had a lot of experience with that kind of hotel.
Did you lay awake often at night overhearing fights that were happening in the halls or another room?
No, I did. When I slept was the hours that I didn't go to sleep until about 8 in the morning back then. And so I had a nice quiet sleep. I was part of the people that was making the noise so other people couldn't sleep, probably.
What were you doing all night?
Well, I was writing, and the whole neighborhood was it was the middle of Needle Park. It was such an enormous shock to me and so thrilling because the neighborhood was filled with hustlers and pimps and prostitutes and drag queens. I'd never seen anything like it in my life.
Not everybody would find that thrilling.
Well, it was thrilling to me. I thought it was the most colorful place I'd ever seen in my life. Also, there were a bunch of guys from Columbia, so I was learning Spanish, and which I
not Columbia University,
didn't learn, not from Columbia University, from Columbia in Costa Rica, and Costa Rica University. So I just found it thrilling. I would walk right up to a pusher and say, "How exactly does a drug transition work? And where do you get the dope from?" And they'd say, "Get out of here, kid!" Because I just wanted to know how everything worked. I thought it was really exciting. So I was usually downstairs in, this is all Baum and Gilead. I was usually downstairs with the Baum and Gilead crowd in that coffee shop.
Yeah, let me explain that Baum and Gilead is a play that takes place in an all-night diner.
An all-night diner,
and it's a diner that's frequented mostly by drug dealers and pimps and prostitutes and other small-time criminals.
Yeah.
So what attracted you to people like that? You were from the Midwest?
Yeah, from a very proper upbringing in the Midwest. Farm yet. Grew up on a farm. And I just think it was, it was raw enterprise that it attracted me. Everyone was out to make a buck, which is true of everyone everywhere. But it was just so raw and bold and obvious there that when I was writing Baum and Gilead, I always said I could really be writing about Wall Street. It would be exactly the same. And that's why I was looking at the economics of it. Also, they had such a great sense of humor about themselves. There were at least five. There was a drag queen and a drug dealer and a fantastic prostitute who just would sit around dishing the dirt, and it was the funniest dialogue I'd ever heard in my life. I didn't ever get the prostitute into a play until I wrote Hotel Baltimore, and then finally the part that Concetta Ferro played, April Green. Finally, I got that prostitute into it. You couldn't say a word to that woman without a comeback.
So what did all the hustlers and con men and drug dealers bring out in you? What surfaced in you?
Oh, I was their pet. I mean, they knew I was writing down every word they said because I would walk up and say, "Would you repeat that, please?" And they thought I was the cutest thing they'd ever seen. You know, they thought I was really very silly. You know, they kind of protected me. I think they felt very protective. When I finished the play, Baum and Gilead, I gave it to a couple of people I'd written about, like an idiot, to read and check for errors. And they read it and said, "Well, that's more or less what it's like." You know.
Do you think if you weren't so naive, it wouldn't have been that easy?
Oh, I'm sure. If I hadn't been that naive, I would have probably been horrified. But and now I'm a little bit shocked at the society that I moved in back then. I can't quite believe that I was in the place when someone was murdered there. That was really horrifying enough. Someone walked in with a knife and stabbed someone and turned around and walked out. We didn't know the person who was stabbed at all. They were from another neighborhood, and we didn't know the people who stabbed him. It was just very alarming, but it was the sort of thing that could easily have happened there at any time. It just hadn't.
Well, after plays like Baum and Gilead and Hot Old Baltimore, you eventually turned to completely different subject matter, which was a family from the Midwest, the Tally series of
plays. The Tally
plays.
Series, right.
It was a family from the Midwest, from Lebanon, Missouri, which I think is where you're originally from.
Yeah, I was born in Lebanon.
Yeah, so this is a family that's not your family, but not probably
not,
unlike...
Not at all my family.
Okay, yeah, but your family must have some connection to them. So how did you turn from this family that was very exotic, very not like you at all, you know, the Baum and Gilead crew,
right,
turn from that to a Midwestern family who absorbed you for five plays?
Yeah, I think they were kind of exotic to me. My connection with that family is my mother cleaned for them.
Oh.
So they were sort of, these were the rich people that lived up on the hill. And And they were exotic to me. I had always wanted to write about them. I had spent hours talking to various members of this family and other people like that. So the whole class, I'd go with my mother and she would clean the house and I would talk to the cook and the lady of the house and the kids that live there. So I always was very strongly attracted to all of those rich kids because we were very poor, and examined them. I mean, you know, I would on the rare times when I went to their houses, you know, I would ask the mother to take me through the house so I could see the way they lived. It was fascinating to me.
Explain what it was about the Talley family that you created, the family that was originally loosely based on the family that your mother cleaned for. I mean, What absorbed you in that family enough to bring you back about five different times?
I think they were America for me. I think they were, and they were changing so much. The war had been had a very profound effect on them. The country was changing, and they were changing, and were not coping particularly well with the change. And that, I think, was the first thing that drew me to them. The whole idea of a family is very interesting to me because it's not at all the way the politicians talk about. We have to create a strong family unit, and everything is for the family. Well, bull hockey. I mean, families are about the most destructive things that's ever been invented. They're horrible. And there are so few families that work. Half the families and half the people in the country don't have two parents. You could name on one hand anyone in a class of, say, 60 that has one meal with the entire family sitting down together. That doesn't happen anymore. I wonder if it ever did. And also the meals that we had at home were the most horrible experiences of my life.
What kind of food?
Well, it wasn't the company, as my stepfather telling us all how to eat, and you know, and it was his only chance to torture the family altogether, and so he made the most of it.
Do you have a group of people you think of as being your family, even though it's not a nuclear family?
Yes. The Circle Rep is my family, yeah. Either Circle Rep or there's another small little adjunct to that. I live in Sag Harbor, and there are few neighbors there that are also I also feel of as very, very important to me.
So what are you going to wear to the opening tonight?
I have to find a shirt. I've got a really nice a sport coat, a pair of gray pants that don't quite match. I've got my hard shoes in town. I'm going to wear my hard shoes and a pair of clean socks, got a clean pair of shorts, new T-shirt, and I have to find a shirt. Either that or I have to iron a shirt. I did all of my laundry, and so all of my shirts are very clean, but they're really kind of rumpled. So I have to go out and find a shirt or a sweater or something to wear with that jacket.
Well, I'll let you get to it.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for talking with us.
It's been fun.
Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Lanford Wilson, who died this week at age 73. He spoke with Terry Gross in 1992, just hours before the opening of his play, Redwood Curtain. Coming up, critic-at-large John Powers notes the passing of another significant arts figure this week, actress Elizabeth Taylor. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Taylor, one of the most iconic screen legends of the 20th century, and one of the world's first and most tenacious AIDS activists, died Wednesday at age 79. Since her death, our critic at large, John Powers, has been thinking about what truly makes a movie star.
I was raised to dislike Elizabeth Taylor. My mother, who taught me about the movies, disapproved of her countless men. She never forgave Liz for stealing Eddie from Debbie, and she flat out scoffed at her acting. "She's only beautiful," Mom would snort, a line I found convincing. Until I reached puberty. Then, like almost every man in the world, I felt the tidal pull of that violet-eyed, raven-haired beauty, whose ethereal perfection contained within it the promise of carnal delight. Taylor was only 12 when National Velvet made her famous. She spent the next 67 years in the public spotlight. The obituaries keep calling her the last movie star, meaning she was the last star from that era when movies were the center of American culture. And I sometimes think she was the purest of them all. Not because of what she achieved on screen. Next to John Wayne or Barbara Stanwyck, her career was flimsy. But because her glamour seemed to soar over anything so pedestrian as a single movie or single performance. This isn't to say that she was a bad actress, although she spent much of her career drifting through forgettable films that were delighted to treat her as only beautiful. She did have a great run in the 50s, from Angela Vickers in A Place in the Sun to call girl Gloria Wandress in Butterfield 8, a role that won her an Oscar. While she never found the director to properly nurture her, as George Cukor did Katharine Hepburn, she was clearly jazzed by working with the giants of method acting. She did some of her finest work with James Dean, Marlon Brando, and above all her beloved Montgomery Clift, himself so beautiful that in Steve Erickson's great Hollywood novel Zeroville, the hero's skull is tattooed with the image of Taylor and Clift in A Place in the Sun. Here, in a famous scene from that movie, Liz's Angela Vickers first meets Clift's George Eastman, the man who will kill to have her, as he's alone shooting pool.
Hello.
Hello.
I see you had a misspent youth.
I guess it was.
Why all alone? Being exclusive? Being dramatic? Being blue?
I'm just fooling around. Maybe you'd like to play.
Oh, no. I'll just watch you. Go ahead. Do I make you nervous?
Yes.
It was Taylor's fate to be at her peak, just as the old Hollywood was dying, and the new Hollywood was yet to be born. She became the first million-dollar star when she agreed to do Cleopatra, that great barge wreck of an epic that was both a symptom of Hollywood's decline, and perhaps the first movie to become best known for what happened off-screen, Taylor's great love affair with Richard Burton. Liz and Dick quickly became the Adam and Eve of today's celebrity culture, pursued everywhere by paparazzi, every detail of their lives duly noted. And what details they were. Theirs was a life, we were told, just bursting with booze, humongous diamonds, extravagant fights, and equally extravagant makeup sex. They made Puerto Vallarta world famous just by showing up there. So what if their lives often seem vulgar? Their appetites, their greedy embrace of life, only made their passion grander and more comprehensible to those fascinated by their every split and reconciliation. Of course, such living took its toll. While Burton died young, Taylor's excesses seemed to be symbolically punished, most visibly in her struggles with her weight, a distinctively American punishment that also claimed other icons, Fat Orson, Fat Elvis, Fat Marlon. And once the 60s counterculture took root, she started seeming more like a blousy joke than a goddess. On Saturday Night Live, her eating was cruelly lampooned by John Belushi, whose own unruly appetites killed him at 33. I'm betting Liz felt more empathy for that wayward soul than he ever did for her. You see, through it all, Taylor didn't simply keep on living as she chose. She helped others live too. Always close to gay men, perhaps because they didn't view her as a sex object, she was one of the world's leaders in fighting AIDS, helping to raise money through her organization AMFAR, And far more important, being willing to talk about it freely in public at a time when the president, also from Hollywood, wouldn't even say the word. Born of the human compassion that was inseparable from her human appetites, her AIDS work was her life's great achievement. Still, that's not what will assure her own enduring place in the sun. Watching clips from her films in recent days, I was reminded that she was one of those rare stars who could flood your head with the image of a world richer and lovelier and more magical than our own. A reality outside of time and space that mere mortals could only dream of touching. Which is to say, Taylor embodied the boundless allure that is, or perhaps once was, the movies.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And from MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition. On the web at metlife.org. This is NPR.
Several TV critics have admitted to having man crushes on Timothy Oliphant. Personally, I just think he's a terrific actor. He stars in the FX series Justified, now in its second season, where he plays U.S. Marshal Raylan Givens. On the next Fresh Air, Oliphant talks about Justified, as well as some of his other TV series, which include Deadwood, The Office, and Damages. Join us.